This new toss is called Our Place in the Cosmos by John Wonderlin. Thanks for coming, John.
Thanks, Beth. And thanks, everybody, for coming. So get starting. Just a little bit about my background. My very first, earliest memory that I ever had was I was a kid playing in my neighbor's sandbox, and my friend's mother came out and said, "John, you gotta run home. It's on TV, it's on TV." So I run home, go into my living room, and my family's huddled around our black and white TV, and Neil Armstrong's walking down the ladder. That's the first memory I see, his grainy picture coming down. I guess it was actually a color picture, wasn't it? But so I've been interested in space my whole life, in science. I've always been interested in it. You know, I'm a big Star Trek geek. And when I was about 7 years old, my father won a telescope for a sales promotion that he was having, and I set it up in my backyard. You know, I was all excited to set it up, and I pointed it at the brightest star in the sky, and I looked through the eyepiece, and I was like, something's wrong. It looked like a crescent. Anybody know what I was looking at?
A crescent.
No, it wasn't the moon. It looked like a star to your eye.
Like Venus, right?
Venus is right. So Venus actually goes through phases, and at the time it was a crescent phase. And so the telescope was fine, but it... But so that was really interesting. Although that was a horrible telescope, and if you're ever interested in buying a telescope, talk to me first, because most of the ones that you buy at department stores are just terrible.
Yeah.
So then when I was 40 years old, my mother sent me a nice fat check, and I knew what I was going to get with that telescope. So I bought a 10-inch Dobsonian. I still have today. It's about this tall, about that big. And it's a great scope. And I had it every single night when we lived in Mineral Point at the time. Almost every night that it was clear, I set it up and I used it and I looked at all the objects, got really excited about it. And so I was, as Nancy will tell you, I get obsessed about projects like this. And so I was Googling for astronomy clubs in the area, and there weren't any. But I found a guy giving astronomy classes in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. And so I contacted him. His name was Dave Esper. He had a degree in astrophysics, I think, was his degree. So we got together and we bonded and became super good friends. And through his classes, and then we had a couple of nights where we got a lot of people together and did some observing, and we started an astronomy club called the Iowa County Astronomers in Dodgeville. And they right now have over 100 members, and they're still going strong, although they're mostly doing virtual meetings still. The person that's running it now is a friend of mine who had leukemia, so he like doesn't want to get, he's been avoiding COVID and everything else like the plague. So, but they it's still a very active club. Also in the part, sorry, I should have gone through this. I also spent a lot of time helping out the Universe in the Park program. If you're not familiar with that, the University of Madison astronomy department goes to the state parks, and they give about an hour-long presentation, similar to what I'm doing here. And then afterwards, they set up telescopes and view the night sky for the campers, and it's a really nice program. But the first time I did that program, several of us from our club went out there, and I could hear it was a grad student. And she said, "Oh, great, the amateurs are here. They always make us look bad." Because we know how to use the telescopes, and all of the grad students, it's like they're trying to figure out the telescope and just can't figure it out. And then I also spent about a dozen years doing hardcore astrophotography that I'm going to show you. So what we're going to talk about today is, first I'm going to talk about an introduction to astronomical scales, distance and size, kind of answering the question, how big is the universe? Then I'm going to talk a little bit about my backyard observatory that I had in Mineral Point and my astrophotos, a little bit about the eclipses of 2017 and 2024, current events, oh, and not telescope tips, I shouldn't, since we're not observing tonight, I'm not going to talk about that. So distance. How far away is the moon?
250,000 miles.
Yeah, that's correct. If you're driving in a car at 65 miles an hour, how long will it take you to get there?
More than two days.
153 days.
Wow.
And that's with no potty breaks. You're right, 250,000 miles. Now, how far away is the sun? Same thing. Driving 65 miles an hour, how long do you think it'll take you to get there?
A couple thousand years.
163 years. It's still no potty breaks. It's 24 hours a day. And it's 92 million miles. So miles are not a practical way to measure distance in astronomical terms. Light is the fastest thing in the universe. It travels at 186,000 miles per second. It can circle the Earth 7 times in 1 second. So again, how far away is the moon if you could ride on a beam of light?
7 seconds.
Actually, 1.3 seconds. And the sun is 8 minutes away.
I was thinking of the sun.
Yeah. So if the sun it went supernova right now, we wouldn't know about it for 8 minutes.
Good.
So solar system distances, the moon, we said, is 1.3 seconds. The sun is 8 minutes. Mars is 12 minutes. And these are average. You know, Mars sometimes is closer and farther away, depending on which side of the sun it is from us. But these are averages. Jupiter, 43 minutes. Saturn is at 1.5 hours. You notice Saturn is twice as far away from us as Jupiter is.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pluto is way out at the edge of the solar system, 5.5 hours. This laser beam would take 5 hours to reach Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
So the nearest star system to us, Alpha Centauri, and also Alpha Centauri is actually a trinary star system. There's three stars that are all orbiting each other, and it's 4.5 years. So if you could ride this beam, it would take 4.5 years to get to Alpha Centauri. Now out to the Milky Way galaxy, our entire galaxy. We're kind of stuffed on one end of one arm, and it's 100,000 light years in diameter. Again, this is the same scale as the moon, 1.3 seconds. This beam of light would take 100,000 years to cover the diameter.
Awesome, man.
The Andromeda Galaxy, which is a separate galaxy to ours, that's a whole other story that I could talk about for a long time, but we've only known that Andromeda Galaxy is outside of our galaxy for about the last 100 years. It's 2.5 million years on that beam of light to reach the Andromeda Galaxy. So somebody on the Andromeda Galaxy right now looking at, if they had a really powerful telescope looking at Earth, they'd probably be seeing dinosaurs on the surface. And now we're going the other extreme, the most distant object known. And I had to update the slide because this was just discovered in the last year. Galaxy HD1 is 13.5 billion with a B years away.
So when is the Big Bang, and how close to the Big Bang is that?
So the Big Bang, so the Big Bang is what, that's a loaded question. So the reason we think there was a Big Bang is that scientists noticed that the universe is expanding, and they can see how far away this is. So basically, 13.5 billion years might be how old the universe is, but it's very convoluted and a lot of discussion. They don't really know for sure yet. The other problem is that at 13.5 billion years away, these things are called redshifted. The light is so far away that it's way in one extreme of the light spectrum, and if there's anything further, we can't see it because the light is stretched too far.
Mm-hmm. But presumably, it's older than the Big Bang would be further away than that because it took time for the
expansion.
To, well, in the, that
right. Oh, yeah. Good point. Right, right.
To develop.
Right. So when the Big Bang happened,
because it takes a while.
Right. Everything was just hydrogen, helium, and some elemental
right.
particles. And those had to condense down into a galaxy.
Right.
So right. So this
time.
Had to be around for a while.
Yeah.
After
there
the Big
has
Bang.
To be a time.
Right. Exactly.
Mm.
Good point.
I forget how many,
good point.
How long they mm. estimate that is,
right.
but it's
yeah.
not over.
I mean, so it took
yeah.
a while
yeah.
for light to form.
Yeah. Well, it took a while for the. So a galaxy consists of stars and hot objects.
Yeah.
The gas has to condense down
right.
to generate enough mass to ignite nuclear fusion
mm-hmm.
to create a star. And to create lots of stars.
Right, and it didn't just happen, you know, boom, and
yeah.
then there's
right,
stars.
Right, right, exactly.
Mm.
Or we don't think so.
We don't think so anyway, right? It's illogical.
Right. So, on summary of the astronomical distances, light speed is how astronomers measure distance. It's a measurement of how far light travels over time. The moon distance of 1.3 light seconds is the same scale as that HD1 galaxy at 13.5 billion years.
Mm-hmm.
Any more questions before I go on? Yeah, Ken.
What is a parsec?
A parsec? I believe it's the distance between Earth and the Sun. I'd have to ask ChatGPT to be sure. Yeah.
I'm just curious, since we're talking about distances. I once heard I don't think he was an astronomer, I think he's a philosopher, maybe, anyway, named Paul Davies, who's Australian, I think, and he wrote a book called The Mind of God, in which, and I heard him lecture, and he claimed, and this would have been, you know, around the turn of this, around 2000 or so, that it's a very humanist society type of question, that man, that you've heard that man is the measure of all things. Well, the idea was that if you look at the exponential figure for the farthest away distance that they knew about anyway then, and so it was something to the nth power, if you then went down to the microscopic level, that man's size was just in the middle of that, which sounds preposterous now, but have you ever heard anything
no.
like that? That things get teeny tiny by the same proportion that they...
Like exactly, like we're
yeah.
like we're right in the middle?
Mm.
Yeah. You ever heard that?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. We, you know, it makes sense for us to measure things large and small, and once again, we're in the center of the universe, right?
Exactly.
All right, now we're going to talk about size. So these are our planets in our solar system to scale. So we are here. You can see how much bigger Earth and Saturn is and how much bigger the Sun is
mm-hmm.
than us. And these are some pretty big objects, right? Well,
we
takes seven, and that's also no potty breaks. Questions on scale.
That's amazing.
Well, what
yeah. Yeah,
right. The last few red spheres, stars.
All of those things were stars. Yeah.
And where are they in relation to the Earth? They're just scattered in the galaxy.
Yeah, scattered in our. These are all in our in the Milky Way galaxy.
Wow.
Yeah. So there might be bigger stars in other galaxies, but they're a little harder to see when they're,
sure,
you know, 25 million light years away.
Yeah.
Telescopes aren't quite that good yet. Yeah, Andy.
Two questions. One is, how do you measure the diameter that seems sort of nebulous? You know, where exactly? You know, it's not like a rocket. This is the surface. It's sort of.
How do you measure the diameter of a star?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you measure? And you know, the other question you're asking is, how big can it get?
Yeah.
And is there a physics limit? Like at certain size, it's going to compress down to a black hole?
Right. Yes. Yes. So there's some different ways they measure. Mostly for measuring distance, there's like three different techniques they use. Because actually, I'll talk about this. One thing they use to measure distance is parallax. I'm not sure if you heard that. You know, when you look at your finger, you know, and blink your eyes back and forth, it bounces back and forth. If you measure nearby stars when the Earth is on one side of the Sun versus when the Earth is on the other side of the Sun, you can actually see movement in distant in relatively close stars. So you can tell how far apart they are. And I think modern telescopes can actually detect diameters of stars now. But I think they also are doing some estimations on this based on the age. And they can calculate the mass of stars. Calculating mass of stars is very easy because of they can detect gravitational forces around stars. So they can detect how much force they have on their surrounding objects.
Mm.
So there's, you know, I don't think anybody's gone out with a tape with a slide rule and measured stars, but I think they're pretty accurate.
My question was more about the width of a star.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that's
how much the distance from Earth.
But it's from the they do it based on the mass. They can calculate how massive these stars are and how much they affect other stars. And again, I'm speaking outside of my knowledge here, but based on where the stars are in their life cycle also determines how wide they are. As the hydrogen is used up, they start expanding. In fact, when our star, when our sun runs out of hydrogen, it'll start expanding and it will probably get so big that Earth will be inside of it, which would be a bad time on Earth.
There's always a Mercury.
Did that answer the question as much as I could?
Yeah.
We might have to ask ChatGPT again on that one. All right.
Was there a physical size before things start collapsing into a?
Oh yeah. So it mostly deals with. So again, once the hydrogens, when the hydrogen which causes nuclear fusion keeps the star expanded, once that runs out of fuel, it'll start doing helium and it expands and then it runs out of gas and it collapses. If the mass of the star is like more than, I think it's a couple, two or three times the size of our star, it'll become a black hole. Our star is too small to become a black hole. It will turn into something called a planetary nebula. It'll shove off its atmosphere and then it'll condense down to something called the neutron star.
Mm.
And I've got a picture of a supernova coming up here. So when we lived in Monroe Point, I built an observatory in my backyard for astrophotography. And this is them pouring in the cement. Cement pier goes down below the frost line.
Mm-hmm.
And this left really impressive ruts in our yard. Here's the deck. And that's the dome. And that's the telescope that I used to take all the pictures you're about to see.
Mm.
So, and I've got the how far away all of these objects are in my slides. This is the Hercules star cluster. This is a great object to look at from a dark location with a good sized telescope. It's very pretty. galaxy M33, 2.6 million light years away. Pleiades star cluster, you can see, it's coming up now at night. You can see this at night. It's just a little fuzzy patch on the in the east, early after dark. 25 million light years for galaxy M51. Bubble Nebula, 11,000 light years. NGC 891 is a great edge on. When I captured this image, it was pretty fun to see the exposure starting. I was like, oh yes. Oh, and I should mention, all of these photos are the result of anywhere from 30 minutes to, I think my longest exposure was 17 hours worth of data capture on a single object. So you can't, when you're looking at a regular telescope visually, you just see a fuzzy little smudge. Mm-hmm. It takes really long exposure to capture clear detail like this. Mm-hmm. And this is the Crab Nebula I wanted to talk about. This is a supernova. This is a great object. Turns out Chinese astronomers in the, it was a couple thousand years BC, noted a new star in the sky that was visible during the day. And of course they didn't know what it was, and it faded over time, and I think it was there for a couple of weeks, and then it faded, and it was still very bright at night, and then eventually it faded away completely, and I'm sure that confused the heck out of them. And it was rediscovered in the 1700s by when telescopes started being developed, and they found this fuzzy blob that it was in Messier. All of these M numbers are from Charles Messier. He cataloged all of the objects in the sky that were not comets. He was a comet hunter, and he was very annoyed at all these fuzzy patches. And it turns out these fuzzy patches are the most revered objects for amateur astronomers now, because they're awesome things like this. So this was a supernova that the Chinese saw. And you can see the expansion of the object, and I should add that to my thing. There are videos from the early images of the crab to today. You can actually see the change. It's very cool. Oh, and the coolest thing about this is this was when they first started using radio telescopes, they pointed it at this and heard this. And thought for sure it was aliens. It turns out at the center of the Crab supernova is a neutron star. It's only a couple of miles in diameter, but it's a couple of miles in diameter that's spinning 60 times per second. So think about something a few miles across spinning 60 times per second.
Making a lot of noise.
In the radio frequency, it's making a ton of noise. That's why it's like a beacon, and they thought it was an alien signal, but don't think it is. It's the Cocoon Nebula, 3,300 light years. It's a little distorted on the display, but galaxy M81, 12 million light years. You can't quite see it in here. There's a companion galaxy right here. It's kind of hard to make out, but on my screen I can see it. Crescent Nebula.
Where does the color come from?
These are all natural color that I enhance it with Photoshop to bring out the colors. But these are all the actual colors. If you were close enough to them, that's what you basically see.
That's unique because you see all the stars in front of it.
Yep. this happens to be in a very dense part of the Milky Way, so there's a lot of foreground stars. They're not embedded in the object. They're actually
between them.
Ghost Nebula. I think this was my 17-hour exposure. Took a long time to pull the data out of the sky.
What is a nebula? How do you define a nebula?
Nebula is just a region of. Fuzzy region. I mean, originally they called the Andromeda Galaxy the Andromeda Nebula because it was something that they thought might be a comet that wasn't a comet, but it was a fuzzy patch of sky. So nebulosity is kind of fuzzy.
And what causes it?
Different things. So different types of nebulas are caused from different reasons. This is just a whole bunch of dust, and it's what's called a reflection nebula. So the stars are the starlight is being bounced off of the gas, and we can see the starlight reflected to us. Oh. There's also things called emission nebulas that tend to be red. This is actually an emission nebula. So this is part of the Orion, this is the Horsehead Nebula in the Orion constellation. And there are new stars being formed in here, and heat causes the gas to glow. So it's not, a reflection nebula is indirect light, like moonlight is indirect light. This is direct light, the gas is actually glowing like a neon light bulb.
So, John, is there a concentration of gas around these that's being lit up, or is it just there's gas everywhere and this is lighting it up?
No, there's gas everywhere and it's all hot gas. And the gas itself is glowing. the better one of the Orion Nebula. This is an emission nebula. So the center of this, right here. These are all brand new stars, and all in here are new stars being born. So it generates a lot of light, and this is actually a fun. My daughter Jenny did the work on this for a high school project. Oh. She actually imaged the color data. Sunflower galaxy, 37 million light years. Black Eye galaxy is kind of fun. You can see the some dark material there. You don't know what causes that, but Whale Galaxy. Comet Lulin, this is from 2009. And can you tell me what these are?
Nope. Or dust.
Somebody say stars? They are stars. Yep. So I tracked on the head of the comet. And the comet's position actually moved in the course of my taking the image, and then these are all star trails.
Okay. When you say you track the comet, is there like software in your telescope that does that for you?
Right. So there's a couple of different things. There's a couple of different things to do, but for that particular one, the comet was bright enough. So with my telescope, I have three telescopes all on one mount. And one of the telescopes actually, I have software that locks onto a star or an object, and it adjusts over time. It keeps the telescope locked onto that spot. So that's what I did with that.
So the comet is moving, or the telescope moving with the comet.
Right. So the comet's
and the other stars aren't.
Right. Exactly. And this is just another comet that happened to be next to a cluster. And my club went out and looked at this visually through the telescope, and it looked a lot like this, other than the color. It was a really great object, 2011. All right, moving on to the two major eclipses we've had in the last few years. This was at Glendale, Wyoming. Population of, I think it was just a few hundred, I think it's like population 250 normally. They had 250,000 people for the eclipse. They had fields of porta potties. They were all prepared other than the highway system. The next day it was gridlocked for like 8 hours. You could not get out of there. But there was a little reservoir there that was really nice. And this boat now is owned by Lynn. We had a lot of good years on it. I hope Lynn gets a lot of good ones now too. That's us enjoying the partial eclipse. And this is me working on the data actually after the eclipse. Oh, I wanted to mention that. So we were primitive camping, had no power, but my telescope needed power. So I used solar panels. You know what doesn't work very well during an eclipse? My battery went right down to the limit, but luckily I was able to capture the data. So here's the beginning of the eclipse.
Wow.
And luckily there were these wonderful sunspots, because I used those to focus the telescope. Without those, I would have had trouble getting it in focus. And here's my first and still my favorite picture of all. This is called the diamond ring effect, where the just the very tip of the sun is poking out. And this is some close-up of the prominences on the surface.
Wow.
And then just this year, earlier this year, we went to Samdale Lake, which you might recognize Casey and Misha, and some other friends of ours.
Yeah, definitely remember Misha.
And this is just my computer. I didn't get any good data of this. I didn't bring any. It didn't have any good pictures of the partial. But this is my solar panels at home. Mm. In Wisconsin, we had like a 90% eclipse here, and this is what happens to the solar power. We had a pretty good just random people coming over to enjoy the eclipse, and that's my one and only good picture I took of it. But this thing right here is it's a prominence, and it was so bright that through binoculars it'd like hurt your eyes a little bit. And through my telescope it was, you shouldn't do this, but I actually looked through my visual telescope without a filter during the eclipse, and it was just like, wow. That was one of my all-time best experiences for astronomy, but super dangerous. It's a solar flare.
Flare. That was the word I was looking for. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions on astrophotography before I move on? Yeah.
Always. You know, does all this light, especially the eclipses, damage the sensors on your telescopes?
No. So I have solar filters that block 99.999% of the light before totality. During totality, it's fine. It's and you can look at it. You can look at it naked eye. And actually, when we were at Glendo, our friend, a friend of ours, had big binoculars. During totality, came around and handed the binoculars to everybody. That's the best way to look at it at a total eclipse. If you ever get a chance to see a total eclipse, use binoculars. It's because you can see the whole prominence and all of the details. Oh, highly recommend. So, anything else? All right, so current events in space. Have you all heard about the poor stranded astronauts? It's like, what's the...
Getting overtime pay, aren't they?
Yeah, overtime pay. There's only two that are stranded, technically.
Okay, yeah.
But you know, the news made it out to be like Robinson Crusoe, you know. And it's just not... At the time, there were 10 other astronauts up there. It's not like they're lonely. Okay. The resupply missions every 3 months. They want to be there. No astronaut I know would be like, oh no, I have to be in space for an extra 7 months. Darn. And I just, my opinion of media science reporting is, pretty awful. Polaris Dawn, I just wanted to talk about briefly. Have you all heard about Polaris Dawn? So it was a SpaceX mission. The first ever fully private space flight, and these guys went up higher than any astronauts have gone since the Apollo mission, and they did what's called an EVA. They didn't do a spacewalk, but they actually poked their heads out of the capsule. Uh-huh. They're testing new suits by SpaceX, and it got almost no media coverage. I'm like, guys, this is amazing. So I was kind of frustrated by that. But
how long were they there?
Just a few days.
And when? What year?
This year.
This was just a few months ago.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Say, John?
Yeah?
Do you recommend any particular media for the ordinary scientist that you do respect to follow this kind of thing?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some podcasts. That's a really good question. I mostly just go to specific sources, but I don't know of any really good science reporting.
NASA has some pretty good.
Yeah, NASA has direct, their direct information, and occasionally NPR does some reasonably good reporting, but sometimes they veer into...
And SpaceX has a library.
SpaceX has some great stuff, which we're just about to look at. I'm so glad you mentioned SpaceX. So I'm also going to show you a little video from Starship Flight 5. Do you all know, have you heard of Starship?
Mm-hmm.
It's SpaceX's, it's this guy in the middle here.
Yeah.
And this is Saturn V, the previous record holder for the biggest rocket humans have ever built. Starship is bigger and can take substantially more payload, and that's a shuttle for reference. It's the largest rocket ever launched. The booster stage is 22 stories tall. That's this silver part.
Yeah.
And it weighs about 300 tons when landing. Yes, the booster lands.
Yeah.
The upper stage soft landed in the upper stage soft landed in the ocean on this run. And the plan in the future is to catch so SpaceX caught this stage. I'm going to show you the video in a second. And the plan in the future is to catch both of them. And the other thing I just wanted to mention about the video you're about to see is it's they had continuous high definition video even when it was re-entering through the atmosphere, which causes havoc with everybody else. I don't know what magic they used for this, but it's pretty impressive.
Attention all flight crew members, this is the final go-no-go pull for operations. Raptor 1.
Raptor 1, let's go.
Raptor 2.
Go.
Stage 1.
Go.
Stage 2.
Go.
Flight directors, go for launch.
Vehicles pitching downrange. Max Q.
So Starship is they're iteratively testing this program, and the intent is to make the thing fully reusable. which will be an utter game changer for spaceflight, like it has been for satellite launches and Americans getting back into space on American soil. Excuse me. Once you know, the plan is that this is going to be our mission to the moon and to Mars, and their intention. Gwen Shotwell is the COO of SpaceX, and she said they plan on having over 400 launches in the next 5 years of Starship. So that's very exciting.
So how long before they can recover the top part, the one that landed?
They're hoping either the next or the one after the next. And they're launching again, I think they were planning on launching by the end of the year or early next year for the next one. And they keep coming closer and closer. They're hoping to get to, right now their other rockets are launching almost every day. And they're hoping to get this one to launch, you know, weekly at least. So, yeah.
Is there any animation in there, or all of
that was all actual video?
Whatever.
No CGI. That was no CGI.
Who's taking that picture?
They have really hardened cameras that, and really good telephoto lenses too. I mean, you know, there's some of them are, you know, it looks really close, but you know. They just have really good
They're
lenses.
All taken from Earth.
Yeah.
or from
the ship itself.
But so they could be much longer, right? They're just giving us a little...
Yes, right. Yeah, that whole thing was about... I watched the whole thing live. I think it was probably about half an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't get Musk's plan. Ideal to be buried on Mars.
Oh, really?
You know, or just occupying it in any way. 65, at least below zero, is probably the warmest.
No, it gets up into the 70s Fahrenheit in certain places. But then the other end, it gets like 100 below zero.
Yeah.
So it's very inhospitable, but. It can get warm occasionally.
Yeah, you know, the dream of going to a hostile place.
Yeah.
You know, just to forget about this place that happens to welcome life.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
Well, for me, I like to think it's not a zero-sum game. I think we can do both. I think we should make this planet as clean and habitable and wonderful as we can. And I would love to see us colonize all of the planets in the solar system and other solar systems. I think humanity should go to the stars. That's my two cents. Yeah.
Watch it, sir.
Why?
What's that?
Why?
Why? If a how many dinosaurs do you know that are around today? Not too many, unless you count the birds, as Jurassic Park claims, right? A big asteroid could take us all out, even today. And
I get that, but even why?
So I think it'd be a good thing for humans to continue indefinitely as a species.
Okay.
As opposed to not continuing as a species, which is what we're trying to do, it seems like sometimes here, right?
You think we're smart enough to do that?
Eventually. Yeah. If you look at the politics, I'm not touching politics today. So.
Right. I think one of the big drivers for a lot of this is going to be economics, people trying to get resources from asteroids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, Mars makes no sense from a business standpoint. The moon makes some sense. There are some elements on the moon that potentially would help with nuclear fusion and other things. But we're actually watching a show I really recommend called For All Mankind. Any of you seen it? It's on Apple. Oh man, it's awesome. They reimagine the Apollo space program as if the Russians got there first. Got to the moon first. And what happens is that the space race is extended like indefinitely, right? So the Russians got there first, so then the U.S. has to one-up them, right? And then the Russian one-up them. So by 2000, the space program's just roaring, and we're on Mars. We have a big development on Mars, and new spacecraft are being developed. But the storyline is very, it's almost like soap opera-esque, but it's very engaging. So, and it's actually made by two of the producers are Star Trek Next Generation alumni, so highly recommended.
You said at the beginning that all objects are all rushing away from us, so there's no real edge to the universe, right?
In that sense.
Any of those photos you took of galaxies, if the Earth is still here, fast forward, 500,000 years, how would the relationships between the objects stay the same? Would the sky be black to us viewing from Earth?
Not in that short of a time frame. Okay. But over billions and billions of years, I'll put on my best Carl Sagan hat.
Yeah.
Billions and billions of years, eventually astronomers are saying that the stars are going to start getting further and further apart, and the universe will get dimmer and dimmer.
Yeah.
Unless there's more bulk out there than we know about.
Unless there's some other physics that we don't know about.
Yeah.
But we probably won't be around for that.
There's been a lot of debate about how to measure the expansion of the universe and the contention there.
Right. Well, and just in the last decade, there was discussion of whether there would be a big crunch where the universe would come back together or come apart, and they were trying to measure what the rate of deceleration is, right? The Big Bang, you think it's going to go poof and then slow down, right? Turns out the universe is expanding faster and faster and faster the longer it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they call dark energy. They don't know what causes this right now. The universe is actually accelerating apart instead of slowing down like intuitively you would think it would.
It has something to do with Jack and the beanstalk.
Yeah. Okay, great, guys. That's all I've got.